You're listening to The Hoof of the Horse, a podcast dedicated to farrowy, hoof care and equine science with Dr. Simon Curtis. Thanks for listening today. The episode is sponsored by the Hoof Care Essentials Foundation and their partners, the Beamer Group and Amy Robb.
Australia is a tough country filled with both stoic people and stoic horses. And we'll hear a little bit about the horses in this interview with Wes Stewart. And we also are going to discuss the natural hoof, barefoot and shod, plus a number of other topics that come up. I've just come out of the International Hoof Care Summit, the session that was going on today, because I've had the chance to speak to Wes Stewart, Australian farrier, who's come over here and just get his thoughts on a number of things. So welcome to the podcast, Wes.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, well, the first thing is, how did you get into being a farrier in Australia?
That's a bit of a long story, so I'll give you the really short version. My father is Scottish,
yeah.
Grew up on one of the last mechanised farms in Scotland. Used to take all of the draft horses down to the local smithy, and Dad being Dad had to know how things worked. Got shown how to shoe, went out to Australia when he was 16, went to the Northern Territory, and because he could shoe, he shod horses. Dad was always big on learning and education, so when I was born and we were shoeing horses, he believed in symmetry in a lot of things. So he used to hang a plumb line from a shoulder to show me how things stand, a plumb line from the hip, and had a stick that everything was measured in. And so I learnt balance, and I learnt to look at symmetry on a horse from Dad. And shoeing, when we first started shoeing, it was because it was a necessity. They were workhorses. So it was just, we shod horses, but there was always there's more to this than just the mechanical thing behind it. And then I got into training reining horses. That is something I really love. But we had no reining horse specialty. So I used to write letters to the trainers in America asking how I could be better. And it was all coming down to shoeing. So I looked more and more and more into shoeing. Did a course through the Equine Education Services, who introduced me to the BWFA. And then I found out that there was more to tack and shoes on.
And the BWFA was the Brotherhood
of Working Farriers Association, so Ralph Casey.
Yeah.
And that there was other people out there. It wasn't just me and my little rowboat swimming around wondering what was going on.
So I had that you started in 85, but you're only counting that from when you shod a horse on your own.
Yes.
Not from the start of your training.
Not from the start of the training. No, no. Dad had me doing horses because I was there. Like, you know, clean out no holes, rasp feet, do those sorts of things since, well, I rode my first horse at 2.
Yeah.
And that was an ex-race horse that Dad was retraining.
Not a little pony then.
Not a little pony. And Dad stuck me on the horse. And he went, Mum is 10 miles that way, stay on the road, because he had to go the other way. So he jumped on the truck and go the other way, and I rode the racehorse home.
Well, that's a good way to start. Now, I have to say, I should have guessed that you were Scottish descent with a name like Wesley Stewart.
That's it.
But, of course, your father must have shod Clydesdales, yeah?
Yes.
And I know that the Clydesdale is called the horse that built Australia.
Yes.
And it did all the hard draft work, and they imported over and over again from Scotland.
Yep.
These wonderful, great working horses.
Yep.
One of the things I'd learned in Australia is they breed down in size, don't they?
Yeah.
So they have to keep going back to the original stock to get the size up.
Yes.
And so it is really interesting, the relationship of the Clydesdale to Australia's settlement and development.
Yep.
Wasn't it? Yeah. So, great stuff.
Yeah.
I know on your website, and you have a great website, You said you had a diploma in horseshoeing from the USA in 1997. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
That was through the Equine Education Services, what they offered, and they called it a diploma course. Yeah. And because it was so far away, they let me do it from home. I did the testing at a police station so it couldn't be dodgy. Because in those days, there was no internet. Yeah. So they sent me the course and I studied. And then I would send them a letter to say that I'd finished that module. And they would send me the test and the sealed envelope would go to the police station. And I'd sit down there with the policeman and I would do my test. And he'd seal it up again and send it back. And at the end of that, they gave me what they called a diploma in horseshoeing.
Well, that's good for you. That shows a lot of, shall we say, persistence in a way. The funny thing is, when I did my diploma in England, I used to do a similar thing, mm-hmm. albeit the letters were only going 200 miles. But nevertheless, I did a lot of it as correspondence. That, you know, right. just save money and travel and all that. So I can appreciate that.
I didn't do it for the diploma. I did it for the education.
Yeah.
I wanted some sort of more formalised training that I could get.
So you've been obviously a stalwart member of the International Association of Professional Farriers in Australia, because I know that you became an accredited professional farrier in 2012, but by 2019 you were president.
Yes.
And are you still president?
No, I'm not. I resigned from that 2 years ago, I think.
But you're still in that association?
I'm still in the association.
Yeah.
It's an association that promotes education. And when I found them, because I've been chasing education and living on a little tiny island where there's only one farrier, and that's me, until you drive somewhere and find out that there must be other farriers because I'm not shoeing all the horses.
Well, and for the benefit of our audience, Australia is about very close to the same size as continental USA, isn't it?
Yes.
Vast country. I remember being on a plane when the pilot said we're now over the coast of Australia, and a couple of the passengers got up and somebody said, you've got another 4 hours to go before we get to, I think it was flying into Sydney or somewhere and cutting across there. Yeah, so vast country.
Yeah.
And of course, most of the cities are around the coast, aren't
yes,
they?
Yep.
And not much in the interior.
No, there's basically nothing. Cattle stations and pubs to support the cattle stations.
I like that. Pubs to support the cattle stations. And I know in Australia people will drive 2 hours or 3 hours for a pint with their mates, won't they?
Yeah, well, because that's how far you got to.
Yeah.
Yeah, like just down the road is a good, hour drive.
But are you in New South Wales or are you in Victoria?
No, I'm in New South Wales. I live in New South Wales, about an hour south of Sydney.
Okay, yeah. Well, I have an Australian daughter in Sydney.
Yes.
And I've done stuff in there in New South Wales, but also across the border in Victoria, which is next door, isn't it?
And just Mexico.
And there's a lot of good... Oh, another new insult. I always knew this rivalry between Victoria and New South Wales. Yeah. It's a great one, but I haven't heard which ones.
Oh, Victorians are Mexicans. They're south of the border.
They're south of the border. Well, you're going to have to build a wall, aren't you?
Yeah, that's it. Keep them out, especially after COVID. They all want to leave.
So, COVID hit Australia hard, but that was another story. Now, I also see that you're a glue shoe adhesives ambassador.
Yes.
And what does that involve there?
So that's with Glue You Adhesives, the glue shoe, the aluminium shoe that's encased in rubber with a cuff on it. And I find that works really well because it's a shapeable shoe. So it's like being a farrier. You've got to shape it. It's not... Yeah. Plastic and it doesn't flex with the foot. And I know a lot of people say the foot's got to flex, but I wear shoes for support and I put them on the horses for the same reason, to support that foot so that things that shouldn't overflex don't overflex.
Well, I remember as a young farrier, which I was once a long time ago, when the first glue shoes came in, and I remember saying that to a great old farrier, Ron Ware, and I said, this will allow the foot to flex. And he said, are you sure we want that?
Mm.
Because, of course, one of the reasons hooves are more, I think they're sounder in a dry climate, is they are 100%. More rigid.
Yes.
You get them in a damper climate and they flex. You only have to lunge your horse on a hard surface to see what happens when the foot really flexes.
Yes.
Because the soundest horse goes lame.
Exactly. Yep.
But that's another story about lunging horses without any shoes on.
Yeah.
So obviously you like that shoe from what you've said, and you.
Yep.
Well, as I say, you're clearly a member of a whole host of associations, because I see you've got a diploma at the Institute of Applied Equine.
I'm doing that at the moment. That's John. God, I'm going to get his name wrong. He doesn't say he endorses trimming. It's different hoof care, and he's looking at the hydrodynamics of the foot as a way of foot function, rather than the typical laminar attachment as holding the foot up. So it's more on the digital cushion and lateral cartilage. Yeah. And basically anything, and that's why I am a member of so many associations, everybody gives you something.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be able to do as good as I can for the horses, I need as much as I can. And while my owners say I do a good job, before I leave this world, if one of the horses went, I'm glad he's my farrier, that would be the topper for me. If the horses were glad I was their farrier, not just the owners.
I'm not sure how we can ask that question.
I know. Yeah, but, you know, it's just that feeling. So anywhere I can get information from, he's offering a course that I can learn from, so I am doing the course.
And again, your website actually says that. It says that you intend clinics and webinars and any learning opportunity.
Yes.
So that gives me the chance to say to you, what is the perfect learning opportunity?
Any.
Well, it can't be any. Especially if you've gone enough, there must be events that you go to and you come away thinking, I didn't get much from that. And there must be ones that you think, that really worked well and I got lots out of
it. But each one, like I was talking to a lady last night and she was saying she didn't want to go to this long clinic because she knew most of it. She only wanted the little bit. And I said to her, well, I'm only here at the summit for a little bit. I've got to do the long, boring 30-hour travel over here to be able to do it. I've got to sit in the rain to enjoy the sunshine. So I'll go to a clinic, and if my takeaway was, okay, I'm not doing it that way, and I know why, then I learnt something, and that was valuable to me.
Now, you also say on your website, you mention natural balance, et cetera.
Yes.
So tell me how you've been influenced by that.
It was more than mapping. It was to be able to find a point on the foot that I could locate again and again and again to measure distortion in the heel and in the toe, and know where things were. I don't want to be rude, but if you're perimeter fit and you don't know what you're looking at and you just put it on the outside, then that foot is going to grow forward. If you know what you're looking at and where things should be, you can perimeter fit a shoe, which is what I do, and get everything good. But to be able to explain it to customers and to be able to show other people what I'm doing, I found that their mapping was fantastic, because I could put a point there. I could show them three different ways of marking the same point. And then I could measure from there back, and I could measure from there forward. And I had something that I could make notes on and see whether I was improving that foot or whether that foot was getting worse. And I could show customers where certain anatomy points were. And
now, I'm definitely not having a go at the natural balance shoe, because I used to use them all the time on laminitics and on tendon injuries.
Yep.
But what I'm really trying to get to is, you know, when they first came out, we were pretty much told that every horse on earth should be shod like this.
Yeah.
So what I'm getting at is, do you think that?
No, I never used the natural balance. Oh, I used a couple of natural balance shoes. Didn't like them because they didn't fit the form and function of a horse's foot as far as I was concerned. So I took standard shoes and put rocker toes on them and brought out the webbing and widened heels and did those sorts of things so that I fitted the foot, but I was still able to find a center point to measure heel growth, heel distortion, toe growth, and toe distortion. So I didn't really get into the whole natural balance shoes. It's more the mapping, that I can map a foot and see how that works, than the shoe.
Because, you know, as I say, I was really, shall we say, influenced, mm-hmm. and I still think it is good to use rocker toes and really get the breakover back, or a rolled toe if you want. And I was very much influenced by that. But of course, the actual thought, and there was that thought, and there was that, shall we say, push to say that this is the way horses naturally wear their feet. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we should be simulating that with all our shoeing. But of course, it was really blown out of the water to that extent in Australia, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It was grabbed, and because we are so far away, when something new comes out and somebody can sell that, people will buy it. Yeah. But for me, I wear different shoes for different occasions. My feet, I wouldn't go barefoot because my feet would wear wrong, so I wear boots to support that. So having one type of shoe that goes on every horse, I just don't see how that's possible. I don't wear one shoe and it fits every occasion.
But what I meant was by the wear of
hooves, yes.
of the Mustang foot, whereas in Australia, when a very expansive and correctly run scientific study was done over, I think, five areas of Australia and New Zealand, was thrown in the Kai Manawera, if I've got that right, horse. It was shown that only one area produced these Mustang rolls.
Yes.
And in fact, there was one area where it was appalling the way the hooves were, you know, these long toes. And of course, so it was all very, what would we say, it was a comfort, I think, for people to say, this is natural.
Yes.
We always get that cuddly, nice, warm feeling about natural.
Yes.
But actually, natural for some horses and some of these groups was pretty appalling.
Yes.
Was, you know, and they had as many pathologies as domestic horses, whereas people would love to think, out in the wild, in nature, they don't get these pathologies, everything's perfect and healthy. And that was pretty much blown away by, Pollitt and Brian Hampson's work.
Yep. Yeah, and I think it was just horse owners seeing a nicer looking foot once that was done, rather than a big splayed, flared foot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we all get a good feeling, don't we, if we have those with all flares and we pull it back, and underneath this awful foot is this nice foot trying to get out. And you know, I used to believe, and I still do, that by and large, if it looks good, it probably is good for the horse, you know. And I know that's not an easy, that's not a very scientific way, and you know, it's not an easy way to teach apprentices and other farriers.
Yep.
But I think people that have been shoeing long enough, and that's the way to think of it. If it looks nice, it probably is right.
Yep.
You know, so there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
Okay, I'm going to ask you three quick fire questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like you to answer them as quick as you can, Wade.
I will too.
Okay, loop knife or straight knife?
Straight.
Warm bloods or thoroughbreds?
Thoroughbreds.
Victoria or New South Wales?
New South Wales.
I think I knew the answer to that. I know I got it written down here, I think. Yeah, so, and tell me, so from New South Wales, do you follow footy, or are you a rugby league man?
Football, because my dad's Scottish.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'm an Arsenal supporter.
Oh, what a burden you have to wear. Well, actually, currently, as we're doing this,
we are leading the table.
Oh, we're running away with the league in England.
Yes.
We're running away with it.
Yep.
So after about 10 dismal years, and so I can understand that you would say that. So,
yes.
So well done. I know there are soccer clubs in Australia, and there's often successful players that make it to the English Premier League. So produce some good ones.
Yeah.
Every now and again.
And our Matildas are doing really well.
And that was that the female?
That's the female soccer.
And of course at the World Cup, I think the Aussie men's team surprised.
Yes, they did. They surprised everybody.
Including themselves. Yeah, no, they did well.
They've got a bit of a habit of doing really well and then getting there and dropping the ball, so to speak.
Well, but they get there. They punched above their weight.
They did. It was good.
So what I want us to do is actually get back and explore a little bit on a similar line to our previous conversation about barefoot and shod. Now, the first question is, should all horses be barefoot?
No.
And why is that?
Because it's not a benefit to everybody to wear the same type of shoe all the time. I don't wear the same type of footwear I did when I was younger. I don't wear the same type of footwear I am wearing now as to when I'm working. So if a horse is relaxing in a paddock, having an easy life, then his feet are not under the same strain as when he's working. When we do something artificial to a horse, we've got to then do more artificial things. The minute we take it out of its natural environment and start artificially feeding it, artificially rugging it, artificially riding it, then we've got to do some artificial protection. I don't mind whether that's casting or shoes or how they're put on, but you've got to offer that horse some protection from the environment that it's being worked on. And not many people are into bondage, as far as I know, but they put all their horses in bondage with their bits and their running gear and that sort of thing, and but they don't offer the horse the one thing that they have, which is protection from the environment. So look, I trim 70% of my horses, but I put shoes on the ones that need protection, correction, or traction.
Yep, that's the easy mnemonic to remember, isn't it?
That's it.
What do horseshoes do? Yep. Those three things.
That's it.
And nothing else.
No.
Sometimes they pay the mortgage a little bit.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
So what I never asked you really early on in this podcast is what type of horses you're shoeing now.
I'm four-legged ones. Everything. We don't really have enough other than thoroughbreds. We have the second largest thoroughbred industry in the world.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But it's not just that. It's the proportion of thoroughbreds to others.
Yes.
That is quite amazing in Australia.
Yep.
You know, in the UK, as a plater, apart from, you know, there's certain farriers stick their nose up in the air when I love to say that. But it's, you know, maximum it's 10% of the horse population.
Right.
In Australia, it's 70-80%
yes.
or more, isn't it?
Yes.
It's quite remarkable.
Yeah.
But you know, the first settlement, once the convicts were starting to be dropped off, immediately, it was really the next voyage. They brought thoroughbred racehorses over, no doubt to entertain the officers.
Well, it all started with one stallion, one mare, three weanlings.
Well,
that was our industry. That's how it started.
Well, as Hans Castellans reported to me in the previous podcast, which I didn't know, is that the horse is more resistant than just about any other species to interbreeding.
Ah.
In other words, they get very closely bred over and over again, and they don't produce, you know, the sort of problems that happen, whether it's humans or dogs. And
right.
And so that's maybe they could survive that.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the Australian Brumby,
mm-hmm.
and again, it's bred down.
Yes.
But, I mean, basically, it was escaped thoroughbreds.
Yes.
And probably a few Clydesdales escaped as well. Or
yep.
who knows? Oh, something that was totally crippled that was allowed just to wander off but managed to breed. So they don't look like that. They don't look like they're thoroughbreds with a bit of Clydesdale in them. But that's because they're bred down over 200 years.
Yes.
And I know they've had additional, no doubt, escapees that have come in. But I don't know if you know, there's more Brumbies in Australia than there are actual domesticated horses in the UK. I know it varies a lot if there's a real drought. Loads them die off, and then if they have a couple of good years,
they come back.
They
again.
Breed like rabbits, and
yep.
back they come. But I think there's 1.2 million on average Brumbies in Australia.
Yep.
You know, most countries do not have that number of domesticated horses.
yep.
So quite extraordinary, really, and how well they survive out there.
Yeah.
But you haven't had anything to do with the Brumbies, have you?
No, I've seen a few. Clear of them. That's it, yep. Yeah. So a lot of people like to get the Brumbie because it's a, you know, our wild horse, and they like to do that whole I rescued a Brumbie thing. Yeah. But when you look at those horses, they're quite a small horse. They usually have terrible feet. Anything that's got it has got terrible, terrible feet. They're hard as a rock.
Yeah.
But they are horrible. They're distorted. They're bent. I found one foot on four will be good. And the others, you go, if I could chop it off and put something even half decent on, I'd be happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, getting back, I know you said you do a great variety of horses, but what types of sports horses do you do? Are you in the racing industry?
No, I don't do race horses at all. I used to do a lot of reining horses before COVID. And then after COVID, because there was nowhere to go, the reining horse really dropped off. The trainers lost a lot of people because they had nowhere to go. And the riding horses, eventers, dressage horses, that is now the majority of my business.
So lots of sports horses.
Lots of sports horses.
So I was right to ask about warm bloods or thoroughbreds,
yes.
Wasn't
yep.
I? So these sports horses, are they tending just to go in the menage? Are they, or do they?
Our horses are paddocks. We have mostly paddocked horses. Sometimes they're brought in of an evening. I would say 98% of my horses live in a paddock. Some of them are brought in of a night time and then they're put out straight again in the morning.
And what's the typical way that your sports horses are shod? What sort of material, what style of shoe?
It depends on the horse, the breed of the horse, the body shape of the horse, as to what I will use personally. I like to put a full rim shoe on. That way we get away from the studs. And we compete mostly on grass. So the traction that everyone talks about with the synthetic surfaces, I don't have that issue with. My dressage horses are all in a standard flat shoe. But the sport horses, I put in a full rim shoe. Some people, if they're competing in really wet weather, then I will put studs in.
I just want to clarify, when you say full rim shoe, you mean a concave shoe?
Yes, a concave shoe, yeah.
That's because we're doing this here in the States and you're translating it into...
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So concave shoe.
Yes.
And, they get lots of grip and purchase.
Yes.
I think, you know, a lot of people are finding that more. The flat shoes may be comfortable for the horse,
mm-hmm.
but they're not as good for performance-wise, are they?
Especially not on grass or dirt. And any cutting horses I'm doing, they're getting a concave on the front, a lightweight, very lightweight. Actually, I put race plates on. Steel race plates on the front.
Yeah.
And the horses that are camp draft horses, which is similar to the American working cow horse class. They're running at high speeds. They've got legs all over the place and they're trying to round up a cow that doesn't want to be there. I shoe them in a steel race plate because it's full concave. It's very light. You can fit it really nice and tight and it gives the horse tons and tons of grip. But they're working on it's actually a ploughed paddock. It's not a fine arena. Quite often it's just run over with a disc plough until it's moderately soft. So you want traction so the horse isn't slipping in that dirt.
It was sad to hear about the reiners because the one thing that COVID and lockdown did in the UK is these horse, you know, that are clients,
mm-hmm.
They were allowed to ride for the welfare of the horse.
Yep.
So the horses were going out and getting more work.
Yep.
And we got a thing where the farriers, where we convinced our government that this was a welfare issue for horses, you can't just leave them untrimmed or unshod. The farriers' work went up in COVID for us.
Yeah, it did the same, but because most of the horses, reining, they went to shows. Whereas if you had an eventer or a dressage horse, you could still ride it at home. You weren't having it with the trainer. So that's where all my work came from. That's where it went from one scale to the other scale. So from the reining horses to the sport horses, and people were still able to trail ride their horse and they were able to jump it at home and do things like that. And then when we opened up and the shows come back, they just went straight into it. Whereas most of the reining horses went off to a trainer to be trained and they had lessons and then they'd come home for a little bit, ridden on the arena to go to a show. And so all of my reining horses, we pulled shoes on. And all the other horses, we shod, and more people went, my horse's feet need shoes now because I'm riding it more.
Yeah, well, that's what we found. Yeah, I know. It's, you have to be careful about being happy about certain aspects of COVID, but that's exactly the same in the UK.
Yeah.
Tell me, do you work with anybody in your business?
Or? No, I work by myself solely. Okay. It's hard to find someone that wants to put in the long hours and the constant days and that. They just,
We're finding that all over the world.
So I'm here.
It's, I'm afraid, it's something that the farrier industry, shall we say, in the Western world, is going to have to face up to somehow.
Yep.
Very difficult to get kids to do the sort of work that...
Yep. Yeah. Well, they want to learn the very basics, and by the time that they're just starting to be handy, they're going, all right, I can gonna go do this myself. I can earn more money doing it myself than you're paying me, and I don't have to do stupid hours.
Yeah.
So it's hard.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I would like to ask you our deep philosophical question of the day, and that is, what do you think is the biggest challenge in life?
Relaxing. There's so many things that stress us and that we allow to stress us, and that's probably the biggest thing, we allow them. If we just go with the flow, relax, the world's not going to end just because you're having a bad day. And if you're having a bad day, the world just keeps rotating no matter how bad it is.
Sun always comes up in the morning.
It does, no matter how bad you're feeling and no matter how much you don't want it to. So just go with the flow.
So what do you do to relax?
Sit with my horse.
Do you?
Yeah. I've got an off-the-track thoroughbred
that's
got a lot of psychological issues as well. And I will go and sit outside and have a coffee and with him. He's a pain in the ass and will try and steal your coffee, but after five or six go-aways, he'll just stand there with you.
Sounds pretty relaxing to me.
It is.
Sounds pretty relaxing.
Yeah.
Well, Wes, we have come to the end of this podcast, so thank you very much for popping out of the latest session here and giving me the time to do this. It's been great.
Thank you for asking me. It's been such an honour that you would ask me to do this.
No, it's my pleasure. So thank you once again.
Thank you very much.
And we'll both get back to the summit.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Well, I didn't think that bondage would ever be discussed in my podcast, but Wes used it, didn't he, to describe the use of bits and shoes. It's quite a take, I think, on the English language to use it in that way. But lovely to speak to a man who is really so enthusiastic still about education and takes every opportunity to improve his knowledge and his skills.
We'd like to thank Hoofcare Essentials Foundation and their partners for sponsoring this episode. You can find out more information at hoofcareessentials.com. You can follow more of Simon's work on Instagram and Facebook at Dr. Simon Curtis. To get in contact, please email thehoofofthehorse@gmail.com. And for everything else, go to drsimoncurtis.com. Thanks for listening.